sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
China's economy continues to slow. Big week coming for markets. What's with all the ads? And our guest today, Tadas Viscanta. All this and much more on episode number 429 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, a good day to you, and hopefully you are enjoying a wonderful weekend. Happy New Year to all of those that are respecting the Rosh Hashanah holidays, the Jewish New Year. This is Andrew Horowitz, and this is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Going to find out a lot more about this, of course, on iTunes, other podcast services, as well as right over on the site at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Follow me on Twitter as well. The handle is Andrew Horowitz, just one word. We have a lot to talk about before we get to our guest. I have a few things I want to mention to you, get to some economics, talk about some things that are going to be happening next week that are kind of important, a recap of the markets from this week, some things on China, the Apple event, lots to talk about. But I thought I'd start with something that's really getting under my skin. I mean, really pissing me off. What is with the internet, the web? What is with web pages? What is with the inability for a web page to be readable anymore? Now it's crept into apps. Now, let me kind of give you the thought here on what I'm talking about and give you a picture of kind of what I'm really so aggravated about. So, I read things like, you know, let's say MarketWatch, Bloomberg, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, you know, the list goes on and on. And some of these have apps. I look at them on my iPhone or my tablet, my computer. Sometimes I look at web pages, you know, the internet itself, the actual Bloomberg.com. And I noticed some time ago, and I've talked about this on DH Unplugged a few times, that it's become very difficult, very scattered. The designs are kind of hard to pin down, gigantic pictures, which sometimes are okay. But to get to actually any meat, you have to just kind of go through and page and click and go. It's not as easy as it used to be. And on top of that, the ads are so obnoxious. Start out on television where, you know, you get 5 minutes of programming, 5 minutes of advertising. It's almost impossible to watch a live show of any sort, news or otherwise. So what you have to do is you have to record it and then fast forward through it. Apps for a long time. Well, there's hardly any ads on there. There's some here and there. You were able to kind of thumb through and do a few things. It's impossible these days. It's gotten just as bad as the web. Apps have become just as terrible. Pop-ups taking over the whole screen. I look at my Bloomberg app, and it used to be a good thing. It kind of can thumb through and click and swipe and find articles and read. And now it's, you know, embedded in each article is a gigantic ad that takes over about a third to a half of the screen. You have to get through there, and if you, God forbid, you touch it, you know, you're going to be right on that ad. And then if you don't do that, after a while, you're kind of thumbing through a few things every couple of minutes, an ad pops up, takes over the entire page. So obnoxious. When are we going to get to a point where we protest this? Now, I'd be personally willing to pay a couple of bucks to have an ad-free experience, but they don't give you those options. Why don't they give you those options? Say, hey, you know what, for $2 a month, $5 a month, whatever it is, you can actually have an ad-free experience. But a lot of these places that you actually pay, you get ads anyway. And I think it's gotten to a point that it's ruined the web. It's ruined apps. It's ruined the ability to look at something or do anything when it comes to, I'll give you another example. How about when you click on a web page these days and a video's on there that maybe you didn't think there was a video, but there was some information you were looking at. And there's a video on there that auto-loads and auto-starts. And it immediately starts with an advertisement. So what's happening here is, here's the trick. The trick is the advertiser gets hit for that particular page view because it auto-rolled. started the advertisement. Even though if you click it off and get rid of it and push stop and I don't want to see it, the advertiser gets hit. One of these days, advertisers are going to wake up to, hey, wait a minute, we're paying way too much for this. And there's no way to monitor this stuff the way that they're doing it. So until that day comes, I mean, I guess the big point is that we're all excited about the ability to charge for advertising on mobile apps and on websites and, you know, take that to a point that it's more revenue and they're doing all sorts of funky things. I mean, I guess to a point, it's the pre-roll when it comes to videos is the same thing as potentially recording a show and being able to pass by it if you can actually get past a particular ad. The advertiser is being charged for the advertisement that shows up on the television, whether you see it or not, whether you fast forward or not. But still, it seems, I find it to be very obstructive, very difficult to get to where you want to go. I don't know about you, but somehow we're going to have a protest. Maybe there's some plugins that we could put into our, you know, maybe there's an app that will be a plugin for no ads. Maybe there'll be, I know Chrome has a few, Firefox has a few. But I got to tell you, I'm sick and tired of it. It's absolutely ridiculous how many ads there are. I don't know how your experience has been with what you do and how things have changed, particularly over the last year, but it's become an obnoxious experience that I don't even want to deal with it. Look, you know, the MarketWatch app is awful. Just littered with ads. Can't even look at it. Bloomberg was kind of the last of the information sources that you can look at. They're a free app, but it's going downhill fast. So there's a few that out there that you pay for, and I have that I pay for that I don't get all that. So I'm gravitating towards those, but I don't know about your experience, like I said, but it has become a terrible inconvenience to actually look at anything on the web these days, not to mention all the ways that they're tracking everything that we're doing. So maybe your comments, if you want to send them on to me, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And I'm sure you have a lot to say about that as well, because it's annoying for everybody. All right, what else is going on out there? Got the Apple event. Did you watch this event? I watched it. I was relatively unimpressed. The big news was a couple of things. First of all, they had a few things about the watch that were pretty cool for the health area when it comes to monitoring hearts, sharing it with doctors, doctors' ability to share information. That was really cool. Okay, that's cool, but is it going to sell a lot more watches? I don't know. The iPad Pro. This bewilders me. They come out with a much larger tablet, about 13 inches, much more powerful. It has a lot of bells and whistles. We'll talk about the stylus in a second. But what I don't understand is why didn't they just take their MacBook Pro and turn it into a touchscreen where you could fold it over and you have like a 3-in-1 kind of situation? Because they also rolled out a keyboard with the iPad Pro. Well, isn't that the same thing as a MacBook at this point? Or the Surface, frankly. I guess they're copying the Surface. So we have a gigantic tablet with an operating system that is okay, not the OS X, of course, it's the iOS. It's not as powerful, but the screen is just as big. I just, for the life of me, I don't understand why none of the Mac laptops or the Mac computers have touchscreen at this point. I guess they're so fearful about the potential for cannibalization of their iPads that they're going to keep on pushing with this whole thing. I just don't see the logic. I don't understand it. Then they introduced a stylus or a pen, $99 for this pen. Interesting. But let me tell you something. Steve Jobs would not have wanted this. Now, the company has obviously evolved. It's grown. It's changed. There's new management, new leadership, new visionaries. But it was clear back in 2007, 2008, I guess that was 2008 or so. Steve Jobs says, man, if you ever come out with a stylus, you could look this up. If you ever come out with a stylus, you blew it. If you ever come out with multitasking, you blew it. In other words, if there was ever a need for this, if there was ever the inability to use just your fingers and point and all that, because who wants to carry around a stylus with them? It's very cool for designers, graphics related individuals, people who have a hard time with their fingers. Clearly a stylus can be more accurate, more fine, a finer point. But besides that, the iPhone 6S, okay, cool, new 3D touch kind of concept. But no innovation except for a little bit bigger, just a touch better. No major innovation, no major changes. same old, same old. The keyboard, okay, that's interesting. But again, if you would have taken the keyboard, combined it with the iPad Pro, but turned it into a MacBook Pro, the 12-inch or the 12.5-inch, or even the MacBook Air with touchscreen, oh, man, that would have been awesome. Awesome. Bah. Not impressed. I like Apple as a company, of course. I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about this particular announcement. It was kind of lame. So the stock did actually come in as they were talking about the pen. That's where things stabilized a little bit. But the iPad Pro was clearly not a winner, and it was not by any means an exciting point. You could watch the, we watched the stock as we watched the announcements and all that, and watch what's going on. And clearly the iPad Pro was the downstroke in the stock price. But still it's hanging in above the key support levels right now. So Apple is definitely trading in a range like the rest of the market. Markets came in last week with a positive performance after a 3% drop the prior week. Let's talk a little bit about what went on with markets before we get to our guest. Economics. This is kind of interesting. The initial September edition of the University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Index came in at 85.7 last week. It's the lowest reading in a year. It was in August, about 91.9, I think it was. Now, a lot of that has to do with maybe some of the turmoil in markets, headlines about China. So generally speaking, things, consumers are kind of getting a little bit cranky right now. At the same time, producer prices or wholesale inflation was kind of nothing. If you look at the Labor Department's Producer Price Index, it was down 0.8%. across the 12 months ending in August. And annualized wholesale inflation now been, I think it's negative for 7 months. And a big part of that, of course, is energy and fuel costs overall. The big news about oil, though, which is contributing to some of the lack of inflation, is that Goldman came out with a call last week that oil could drop to $20 if all things just set right. Of course, oil rallied after that announcement, but still $20. I mean, this is coming down a significant amount when we just touched below $40 a couple of weeks back, and then we saw that big reversal and that move higher. But now with China continuing to slow, even though there was some reports about refining activity in China was pretty good, with China slowing as it is, with the potential for a rise in the dollar, if in fact the Fed does come in next week on Thursday and raise rates a bit, although I think a lot of this is baked in already. I think there's a lot of assumption that this is going to happen, although Goldman also said that, hey, the Fed should be actually loosening, not tightening now. So overall, the year to date, Dow Jones down 7.8%. NASDAQ's up slightly about 1.5%. The S&P's down about 4.75% for the year to date. So a few things happening. Like I said, you have nothing really major on Monday. Tuesday, you have retail sales, which we'll be watching carefully with the consumer confidence issue. And then the big thing is Thursday. This is what we're really looking at, is Thursday. What's going to happen then? So something we're going to look at. Let's get to our guest. How about that? And our guest today is Tadas Viskanta. And we had him on before a long time ago. He is founder and editor of Abnormal Returns. You can read all his good stuff there. Also author of a book by the same name. And we're going to talk about some interesting market things and related to behavioral analysis and what's going on. So I welcome you. How are you, my friend?
Hey, I'm doing great. Glad to be on.
Thanks. So let's, the last number of weeks has been, let's just say it's been different than the last couple of years, right? What's going on?
Yeah. Well, absolutely. No, I think, part of me says we're kind of been due for some volatility. You know, we've ever since, the kind of the bounce back from the global financial crisis, we've really been in a 5 or 6 year bull market. And it's really been pretty unrelenting. You know, we've had a couple of dips along the way, but anybody who's kind of come to investing in the last 5 or 6 years thinks it's probably been pretty, it's been a pretty easy gig. Mm-hmm. But in fact, these last couple of weeks have been a great wake-up call for investors. I think, this is more, in a certain sense, this is more normal sort of market behavior. Obviously, it gets exaggerated by the fact that, we're kind of in a global interconnected market and we're looking at what China's doing and what Europe's doing overnight. That obviously affects things in a certain sort of specific way, but volatile markets up and down are, more the norm than not. And so I think, these last couple of weeks have been a good lesson for investors in terms of their behavior and their reaction to the market.
You know what I find interesting is that over the last year or so, we've had an enormous move in the area of robo investing, which is, as far as I can tell, the sign that the average investor thinks things are really easy, right? Because, you know, you just kind of, it's like the Ronco of investing, right? You set it and forget it. Different than buy, different than buy and hold, of course, different concept, right? But it's like, I don't know what it is, but I think that maybe I want to retire at age 60. So I got to make like 7% per year. And this portfolio, when I do the dials and a couple of buttons says that I'd make 7% a year, I just leave it there and go. And that was kind of, I think, the point where I woke up and said, wait, to the fact that, wait, is there that much complacency out there, right?
Yeah, no, I think that's the underlying tension. I would probably be more, I'm probably more favorably disposed to the robo-advisors in the respect that I think that it's a great starting point for young investors and for people getting started. And I think, so from that perspective, I'm probably more positive on the robo-advisors. But yeah, one of the underlying assumptions is that, you know, that you have normal sorts of markets and that, you know, and so this is going to be an interesting sort of signpost for those companies to see how their investors have reacted and how, whether they put more money in or take it out or how they react to this sort of environment. And so I think it's definitely going to be a, you know, an interesting time for those guys. And then, like I said, I'm probably more favorably disposed towards them, than you are, but I think it's going to be a great lesson, you know, be a great case study here for, somebody looking back in a year or two.
You know, just as a point of reference, I think they have their place, like everything does, right? There's a place for active management. There's a place for trading. There's a place for passive management. There's a place for robo-investing. So I agree with that. I just think that the way it was being brought was, hey, this is for everybody. And that's where I think the one, which I don't think you would disagree with that, right?
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. And you know, trying to put any sort of return, you know, any sort of number on what you could expect to earn over time would be a mistake. You know, I think everybody, you know, we've all been dealing with this issue of low interest rates for quite some time now. And that really does put a damper on what you could really expect going forward. You know, when treasuries yield 0, 1, or 2%, what are reasonable expectations above that for, a riskier portfolio that might comprise, you know, equities and some other asset classes.
So let's talk about the whole idea of low interest rate environment from the aspect of your thoughts on whether or not the media and, you know, people in general are putting too much weight on this whole notion of, oh my God, there's going to be a September liftoff. No, there's not. Oh no, they're waiting till October. No, they're going to do it in September. By the way, whether they do it then or never, do you think there's just it's gotten to a point of being semi-ridiculous how the handicapping is all going. And if you, by the way, one other point, if you watch any major business show, that's all they talk about.
Oh, absolutely. This is catnip for the financial media. I mean, you have a discrete event on a certain day that'll happen at a certain time. They can prepare, you know, they can prepare their graphics to put on the screen, Fed raises, Fed stands pat, whatever the case might be. This is custom made for the financial media and financial television. So it's not surprising that they continue to pound on this. But you know, I think it's a much bigger question as to, you know, frankly, I would like to see them do it just so we don't have to talk about it anymore. So from my perspective, you know, it's hard to see how 25 basis points could affect things a lot. But again, that's just my assumption. You know, we're talking, like we said, we're talking about an interconnected world where, people start projecting on follow-on from that. And so, you know, so on and so forth. So, you know, from that perspective, it's hard to say what exactly would happen if the Fed were to move. But like you said, it's something that if investors are really focused on that, they're focusing on the wrong thing.
Yeah. You know, I would just like to say that I have been for the last year or so in the camp that I would prefer a hike in rates for this respect, in that if there is complacency about, they're not going to raise rates, I don't have to worry about things, that is the epitome of where and the genesis of deflationary tendencies. You know, if you can wait to buy something and you're not going to do so till the price goes down, you know, it affects the supply-demand chain. It affects all that. I think that if, in fact, there was a slight or reasonable level of increase in rates, that would get people off the fence on many things that they were potentially going to do. Now, it would hurt other areas as well. But I think that from an economy standpoint, it would be very beneficial.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, people have been talking about, you know, mortgage refinancings and things like that. And like you said, that could be a spur for that sort of activity. From the Fed's perspective, kind of my you know, dime chair Fed quarterbacking would be, I would think they just would want to get off the zero bound. Yeah. I would think that that's an uncomfortable place for a central banker to be. You really have no leeway at that point, one way or another. So, you know, I think from that perspective, I think part of it would be just be kind of pulling off the Band-Aid in a certain respect.
Yeah. Now, there's been a lot of data out there, a lot of information, trying to understand what's going on, not only from the Fed standpoint, but also from what we hear from Europe, China, central banks, which have taken the lead. There's so much information that is flowing on a regular basis, you know, over the last, you know, few years, where all these news, Twitter, you know, a variety of different streams. How do you, how would you give me advice as an investor to sift through the information, aside from just ignoring it and, you know, thinking it's just noise, but, you know, to get to the real information, the meat of what I need to understand and look at?
I think you kind of hit it on the head. I think a lot of it is noise. You know, you could spend, you know, like you said, you could spend all day debating the merits of what the Fed should do at their next meeting. And it's not clear to me that would have any sort of positive effect on what you would do as an investor. I think investors need to focus on those things over which they have some control. And whether that be, if you're a passive investor, focusing on your asset allocation and focusing on lowering your costs. If you're an active trader focusing on your process and whatever sort of, you know, variables that you're looking at in that respect. So I think, you know, a good motto is probably less is more. I think you have to be pretty brutal in terms of your culling down the sources which you're looking at. You obviously don't want to get to a point where you're only looking at a narrow range of news sources or commentary that you have blinders on. I think you have to be very conscious that you are taking in kind of a wide range of voices, but taking in too much, I think, is absolutely deleterious. You're just gonna get jerked back and forth.
Right.
The tendency for investors is to agree with the last thing that they read, and if that's the case, you're, like you said, you're gonna get whipsawed and you're gonna be constantly looking to change up what you're doing, when in fact picking a strategy and following through on it is far more important than trying to worry about the wiggles in the economy or the last day in the stock market.
Now, let me switch up on another topic here. I know that over the last number of years, historically, the idea of investing in a hedge fund was, even though they were called hedge funds, some hedged, some didn't, you know, they were just did all sorts of different things. You look at the universe of hedge funds these days, and there's a lot of them. But what's your general opinion on the whole universe of hedge funds, what they're doing, and if in fact they are today still providing investors with kind of an uncorrelated asset class to invest in?
Well, I think all the that's a big question and a great question, because, you know, the argument would be that on the margin, you know, hedge funds are kind of the marginal investor, and they kind of set prices on the margin. So I think from that perspective, they are an important topic, and I think one that's worth, you know, one that's worth keeping an eye on. I have to take one step back and say, look, they are obviously, you know, the primary investors for hedge funds today are institutions.
Yep.
Pension funds, endowment funds. So for whatever reason, good, bad, or indifferent, they continue to hold their hedge fund positions and add to them. And in fact, the industry by and large is getting top heavier. The most successful funds continue to attract the most asset inflows. And those guys are in a certain respect, continue to get bigger. And so for whatever reason, they have found a formula which allows them to continue to attract assets. I think all the data, all the research and all the data would show that hedge funds on average don't really provide you any alpha. And so from that perspective, the notion of hedge funds, even the name hedge funds, really comes from a time that's, you know, from the distant past. We're talking about 20, 30 years ago when there were really smaller, more nimble vehicles that were really trying to shoot the lights out. And now they're far a much more institutionalized product that's really trying to generate moderate returns with moderate risk. And I think that, you know, fees aside, I think, luckily for most individual investors, they don't have to worry about having to make those sorts of decisions about investing in hedge funds. You know, it's much more an institutional issue at this point.
So there's a difference between hedge funds and mutual funds and ETFs, of course, right? So hedge funds can actively, for example, I'll give you a way out example. So you have an ETF that invests in the S&P 500 and they have their core portfolio and they're going to add to it as new monies come in, right? You follow what I'm saying? Whereas a hedge fund could take their block of money theoretically and invest it in one stock or in, you know, work the futures markets overnights if they had that edict, if you will, or shift totally out into cash or into bonds on a, you know, moment by moment basis. There's been some talk about ETFs with the amount of money. We're talking massive amounts of money and the ability to move money in and out of the ETFs intraday, causing excessive or creating some of the excessive volatility that we may be seeing. In the old days, it was the hedge funds that did that, right? Is there any truth to this?
That's not something that keeps me up at night. I mean, I think by and large, the creation process for ETFs is a pretty well-worn one. I don't worry about money flowing in and out of the SPY or the IVV or, the S&P 500 stuff. I think that process is pretty well known. And, you know, obviously on a day when the market opens down, the Dow opens down 1,000 points and some stocks are open and some stocks aren't, there's going to be a little bit of chaos. But I think that's something that you just have to, to a certain respect, you just have to live with. Markets aren't perfect. And certainly the markets that we live with today aren't perfect. You can make all sorts of arguments about, market microstructure and we have too many exchanges and the data and the high frequency traders. That's a whole other discussion. So markets aren't perfect. And in that respect, ETFs aren't going to be perfect either. But I don't really see them as a source of additional volatility. I think, like you said, to a certain respect, the markets are going to do what they're going to do. And mm-hmm. I think if money's going to flow, it's going to find a way, whether it's through, like you said, through the futures markets, through ETFs, through individual securities, the option, the VIX or the options market. So that doesn't keep me up at night.
What does keep you up at night?
Honestly, not a lot. From a market perspective, not a lot. I think, everybody would say that, obviously everybody would like to see, the valuation of the U.S. stock market come down a little bit. And I think that would give everybody a little bit of pause. I think the biggest thing, one of the biggest things right now that, when you talk about, we're talking about hedge funds as kind of the marginal price setter for securities. If you think about China over the last 10 or 20 years, they've been the marginal buyer of all sorts of materials. And I think that you've seen, I think that the markets are saying China is slowing. The question is how much. The commodity markets have certainly reacted pretty negatively to all the news that's coming out there. And I think that, from a positive perspective, you've already priced in a lot of that. I think that the behavior from the Chinese stock market was pretty anomalous in terms of having this huge run up and this huge dip in an environment where the economy was, by all accounts, slowing. So I think that's a great lesson that teaches people that the economy and the stock market can be two very different things.
Yeah, and it was actually the opposite. Every time there was a bid, when the market was running up, the worse the data, the more the stock market would go up.
Yeah, and I think that's, I think that's one lesson that investors need to keep relearning. I think if you have been sitting out of the stock market for the past 5 or 6 years because you think the U.S. economy, was in the dumpster, you missed out on a huge bull market rally. And I think that investors who confuse those two, I think you have, you know, it takes a little bit of self-awareness to kind of step back and say, hey, the economy is not necessarily the stock market. They can be doing two different things. They can disengage on the upside and they can disengage on the downside. And so I think from that perspective, you know, if nothing else, what's happened in China over the last year is a great lesson in that.
You know, I don't know if you heard me talking about this, but one of the things about China is, you know, the believability of data and how the government has gone about propping up their economy. And I was recently there. I don't know if you've been there at all, but I was recently there. And, you know, you hear about these ghost cities. You see the satellite imagery of them. And I don't know what your take is on this, because they've been, to a point, you do see these. And to a point, there are people that say, hey, no, that's not true. I've actually seen people on television say that it's not true that there's all these ghost cities, okay? I was there. They're there in mass. In mass. It was frightening seeing the amount of empty. I'm not talking about one or two. I'm talking about massive structures in pooled with, let's say, 10 different gigantic apartment buildings, one after the other, all these projects going thick backwards for 50 miles on one particular road that I was traveling. It was unbelievable. But just as a point, you know, the government, at the end of the day, it is a communist country. The government owns essentially the land. The government owns, as they're telling us these days, they own the stock market. I mean, they're telling us that, right? That it is their stock market. They have not done a good job, because they obviously aren't putting enough money to counter the amount of money that's being taken out. But the fact is that they're the number two economy in the world, and, you know, their slowing is significant. For whatever reason that they're slowing, it could be, you know, currency issues. It could be just they made a wrong turn trying to create an economy based on domestic demand versus an export, which they had all these years. But anyway, I don't know where in the world is, in your opinion, where is your kind of favorite places to be? That, hey, there's a bright spot, or maybe it's a sector, or maybe it's a particular stock. I don't know. Just where's the bright spots these days?
Well, I think right now, I think, you know, the time to start is to start looking at from a contrarian sort of perspective and start looking for stuff that's kind of gotten bombed out. Like we were talking about, you know, the emerging markets ex-China, I think is something to look at. You know, there's the sentiment towards the emerging markets is really highly negative. And I think that, you know, when you get in those sort of situations, it doesn't take a whole lot of good news to kind of turn things around. So one other area that I think is interesting, and that is a kind of part of me, it plays a little bit of a sentiment role as well, is I like to look at closed-end funds and see what's going on there. And closed-end funds, you know, it's obviously kind of a small part of the market and a little bit of an anachronism anymore. But, you know, the discounts on closed-end funds are at some of their widest levels and, you know, since the financial crisis. And that tells you, A, there's a lot of fear, and B, there might be some opportunity in there where you're able to buy, you know, some of these funds at a big discount to net asset value. So I think those are kind of two areas to start thinking about in terms of, you know, again, one of these days, you know, commodity markets have just gotten bombed out. I mean, it's really, when you look at how deeply they've fallen, it's really quite stunning. And again, there will be an opportunity there, whether it's today or a month or two or a few months from now. But at some point, you know, there will be an opportunity there as well.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you have to get into it before or get into something that is bombed out, is destroyed, has the wherewithal to stay afloat. We saw that Quicksilver, an oil-related company, filed for bankruptcy last week. But, you know, you have to find the ones. I mean, but if you look at some of the big ones, I mean, I've been of the camp that there's going to be a time where some of the small players, the frackers, et cetera, are going to be gobbled up by the big players, because it's, you know, why not? Where they can't survive anymore, or they're looking for a better deal, big guy, whether it's a Chevron or Exxon, whoever it is, starts buying some of these that are ready-made to just turn the pumps on when oil prices start moving up. Many of these smaller guys that just can't hold out any longer. There may be a wave of that coming. So we'll see. Where is an area that you have a concern then?
You know, I think I think interest rates are, you know, I think that's the big question. And I think that, you know, the challenge for investors is, do do you continue to treat fixed income as a ballast to your portfolio in an era where interest rates are so low and where you have kind of one-way risk? You know, the best case is that rates stay here. You know, the worst case is obviously rates going, you know, substantially higher. So, you know, I think that's kind of the eternal question for investors and how you deal with that, how you kind of deal with that on the margin. So, you know, I think for most, you know, most investors probably have some sort of, you know, or have a balanced sort of asset allocation, which includes fixed income. And I guess the question is, you know, how do you deal with that, both from a practical perspective, but also from a psychological perspective? You know, if you're saying, look, I'm going to continue to hold X percent in fixed income, and I recognize that, you know, if interest rates were to rise, I'm going to have to hold, you know, I'm going to have to grit my teeth and, you know, hold through a period of rising rates. And so I think that's the big question for investors who have a broader sort of perspective.
Yeah, one of the things that we've done is we shift a lot of, even though we've shortened maturities, for our clients, what we've done is we've gone to floating rate funds as a way to possibly protect against an increasing interest rate environment. Not too long ago, we did this. And they're holding up. They pay a decent interest. The hope is that, you know, we're not going to see this as a principal erosion in the event of a freak out by bond markets, which, by the way, has not happened yet, which is really quite amazing if you think about it. With the Fed being pretty much on cue to raise rates, you're still seeing bonds even, relatively close to their all-time highs. Close. Not the high yield bonds sector, but generally speaking, I mean, bonds really are not too far away from where they've been, within a range.
Yeah, and that's consistent with, you know, what's going on with yields in Europe and around the world. So that's, from that perspective, it coincides with that sort of observation. And like you said, that, you know, that might be the best argument for raising rates now, is that you have a market that's ready for it and poised for it. And if there's ever a time, you know, maybe that's the opportunity.
Right. All right. Well, I appreciate your spending some time with us. We're going to put the links to your website, and you can follow. What's your Twitter handle?
At Abnormal Returns.
Oh, that's easy enough. I'm going to put all that there, links to your book, et cetera, and you can follow Tadas. And I appreciate you coming along and spending some time with us today.
It's my pleasure. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye. Now, before we got to our guest, if you recall, we're talking about markets. Some of the things happening next week coming up is probably the all-important Fed meeting that will occur on Thursday. And I think the big issue here that we need to really focus in on is what kind of statement they provide. Now, I was thinking about, what are they going to do, right? I mean, they talk about, well, we're in a tightening mode potentially. September was the date. We hit 5.1% on unemployment. Inflation is pretty close to their target number. Not exactly there, but they don't want to get that too far away from them, even though it doesn't seem like inflation at a major rate is a problem right now, particularly in the rest of the world. In the U.S., maybe a little bit at 1.8% or so on a year-over-year basis the CPI side of things. But, you know, I find it really interesting that the rest of the world obviously is hurting tremendously due to many of the commodity problems that we've seen, the pricing slides on oil and various food products, as well as metals. The slowdown in China, clearly number two economy, is hurting things overall. And there's not much ammunition left by central banks. I mean, they could try to keep pumping money in, but after a while, it becomes rather ineffective. But here's the thing. So, you know, if they do in fact tighten from the 0 to 0.25% level that they have now, what are they going to do? Are they going to go to 0.375? Are they going to say, hey, you know what, we're just going to go to 0.125, which is a raise if you think about it at the bottom end, but still below the top. And in fact, if they do something like that, as crazy as that sounds, it could be construed as a loosening bias by some, but yet a move by the Fed to tighten to bring up the lower bound of zero. I don't know if that's even possible. I mean, these days, anything's possible. Fed, you know, is doing a lot of unconventional types of operations right now. So instead of a quarter point, maybe they'll do, you know, an eighth. So if they did that, that would be really interesting, because I think that would pacify some that were looking for some kind of a tightening move, or at least a move by the Fed to get off the zero bound. And at the same time, not really be a problem because you look at it as a loosening from the top level. What do you think about that? Possible? I think it'd be really interesting if the Fed does something like that. I mean, I won't be surprised with whatever they do. I think the only thing that will surprise me is for them to do nothing right now, because they have telegraphed so clearly that they want to start at least by a show of that they can do it, that maybe even though they are still doing QE in the background with reinvestments of current principal payments that are paying off on bonds, as well as interest payments to the tune of about $20 billion per month, they're still doing that, keeping rates down pretty well. I still think that they're trying their best to show some strength here and show that the economy in the U.S. is doing better and that they are willing to do something here. But at the same time, they don't want to do it at the risk of crippling the rest of the globe, which we have such an interrelationship with. So I think they got a tough decision here. They really do. I don't know about loosening any further. I don't know what they could do to loosen further. There has been some speculation that even a new quantitative easing program will actually be announced. I think that's crazy. You know, with all things being equal, even though manufacturing has slowed a bit, even though factory inventories are on the rise and sales to inventory ratios are on the rise, which is not good, meaning people aren't buying as much. Consumer confidence is down a bit. Markets obviously showing a bit of strain. The earnings outlook looks a little bit muted due to the fact that you have the dollar so strong. All these things combined, I don't think they want to do anything crazy here. But at the same time, you do have a 5.1% unemployment rate. You do have initial claims, some of the lowest levels you've seen in a long time. You do see that retail sales are holding okay. You know, you're seeing that the housing market is doing pretty good. You do see a lot of things like the service index here is doing fine. Import, export, okay. Durable goods looking all right. Leading indicators, we'll see that at the end of next week. But so far, so good. Nothing is collapsing. Nothing is slowing a little bit, but a normal economic cycle. So what are they going to do? I think they have a pretty tough decision, like I said. We'll see. It's going to be very interesting. We'll come back next week and we'll talk about that as well. We have some great guests coming up next few weeks. I'm going to bring back Das. He'll be back shortly. Frank Kersey, of course, one of the favorites. We'll have a good amount of folks. If you have anybody that you want us to bring back that we haven't had on for a while, or someone new that you think could be interesting, I got to bring back Tom McClellan. He has some interesting calls recently on markets. He's pretty dour right now from now through the mid part of next year on the market cycle, and he believes it's going to be a pretty hairy move to the downside. All of his indicators that he uses are very mathematical, very statistically oriented, very clear, concise, and repeatable types of analysis he does. Calling for a pretty ugly situation. We'll see how that works out. Anyway, we're going to end it early on the holiday weekend. It is, like I said, Rosh Hashanah. Got a lot of family coming over. We'll talk to you again next week. Of course, please do me a favor. Listen to us on DH Unplugged. Myself, John C. Dvorak, talk about all sorts of fun things. Got to check that out. This is a pretty cool show. It's funny. It's informational, entertaining, to say the least. Any questions? Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks for joining me. See you soon.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.